until all the votes are in, it's an open question. But it's looking better.
Candidates in close races react to new ballot count numbers. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, November 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an unprecedented archaeological find in interior Alaska.
It does suggest that there is an importance of hunting implements within the burial ritual, and this might reflect the importance of terrestrial hunting within the culture itself.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
After a week of collecting and reviewing absentee ballots, workers at the Division of Elections are now running 17,000 of those uncounted votes through machines. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez is at the Anchorage office observing the process. Hello, Alexandra.
Hi, Lori.
So, Alexandra, going into today, Democratic Senator Mark Begich was 8,000 votes behind Dan Sullivan, his Republican challenger. And in the governor's race, Republican Sean Parnell trails unaffiliated candidate Bill Walker by 3,000 votes. Have we seen those numbers move at all?
Well, we got an update a little after 4 p.m., and there should be another one later this evening. 8,000 votes were added to the tally, but they really didn't move the needle all that much. Sullivan very, very slightly increased his lead, and now Begich has to close a gap that's closer to 9,000 votes. Meanwhile, Parnell closed his gap, but by a few dozen votes. That's well short of what he needs to overcome Walker or even get him within the range of demanding a recount.
So your downtown Anchorage at the Division of Election Office, what's the scene like there?
Well, watching people count votes has been like going to the world's most bureaucratic zoo. You have four election workers who are working really hard at tables, and there's a chain barrier in front of them where reporters and political types are watching them. The newspaper photographers all have their cameras, and I'm there with my recording here, and it's like these people are on exhibit. I kind of expected the whole thing to seem a little more automatic, but it is literally just people pushing thousands and thousands of sheets of paper.
The votes that are being counted today are only about a third of the ones that are left outstanding. Where are they coming from?
Well, they're coming from Kenai, Ketchikan, the western part of Fairbanks, Eagle River, and parts of the Matsu. Those are the districts that are seeing the most votes counted today. With the exception of the Fairbanks district, those are areas that went pretty heavily for Republican Dan Sullivan. Parnell also fared relatively well in those areas last Tuesday. So that batch of absentees could be even more Republican than the outstanding ballots as a whole. With the tally that we just got, though, that was a mix of Matsu votes, coastal votes, and rural votes, and some from the Anchorage and Fairbanks district. So that was actually kind of a pretty representative geographic sample.
So where do we go from here?
It's kind of a start and stop process. After the counting ends tonight, there won't be any more votes tallied until Friday, and then the process could even go into next week.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Alexandra, and giving us that update.
Thank you, Lori.
That was APRN's Alexander Gutierrez calling from the Anchorage Division of Elections office. Division of Elections workers have counted all of the reviewed ballots they had for House District 21, the West Anchorage race between Democrat Matt Klayman and Republican Anand Dubé was too close to call on election night. Klayman was winning by 35 votes. An additional 942 votes from the district were counted today. New numbers put Klayman ahead by 86 votes. Klayman observed the process at the Division of Elections in Midtown. He says he's not calling it yet.
Until all the votes are in, it's an open question. But it's looking better.
Another close race, House District 36 of Ketchikan, is updated, and Cher Klein now leads independent Dan Ortiz by 9 votes. It's unclear how many how many more votes from the district still need to be counted. The division is still opening and verifying ballots. They'll continue counting the district on Friday. An archaeological site southeast of Fairbanks continues to yield information about the native people who lived along the Tanana River thousands of years ago. The site, first identified in 2005 during reconnaissance for a railroad extension project, has been the subject of major archaeological excavation. And yesterday, researchers announced the discovery of skeletal remains and other materials dating back to the end of the last ice age. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the findings are helping to broaden understanding of Alaska's early residents.
Researchers announced the 2013 discovery of skeletal remains of two babies that date back 11,500 years. The infant remains are the youngest Ice Age individuals to be unearthed in the northern part of the continent. Their burial site is part of an ancient Alaska Native camp where the cremated remains of a three-year-old child of the same era were previously found. University of Alaska Fairbanks archaeology professor Ben Potter shared details of the latest finding during a teleconference, saying it furthers insight into ancient interior Alaska Native culture.
To have infants this young being preserved with all of the elements intact, we can identify a lot of the human behaviors that went into the burial, the mortuary behaviors associated, the rituals that are associated with the burial, as well as just an unprecedented series of grave goods that we really haven't seen for this period.
The infant's gravesite included some stone weapon tips and portions of decorated bone shafts.
So it does suggest that there's an importance of hunting implements within the burial ritual, and this might reflect the importance of terrestrial hunting within the culture itself.
Potter credits preservation of organic materials at the site known as Upward Sun River to the acid-free sand surrounding them. The site also includes hundreds of salmon bones, a find Potter says indicates the area may have been a fish processing site.
And of course, that's really exciting to archaeologists because it really gives us a broader picture of overall diet, overall subsistence strategies within this very early period.
Potter stresses that archaeologists have worked closely with local Native people and organizations throughout the project. Tanana Chiefs Conference Executive Director of Tribal Government and Client Services, Will Mayo, urges those involved to be mindful of the conflict between science and long-held cultural rules against disturbing the dead.
By your participation in this, are helping to change a culture, are part of a change of a culture. And that's a weighty matter.
Mayo acknowledges valid scientific intent, but maintains it's causing cultural conflict. Former TCC President Jerry Isaac agrees and expresses optimism that analysis of ancient remains may lead to better understanding and treatment of modern Native health problems.
Nobody knows why the Alaska Native people are so prone to cancer and other terminal illnesses.
Additional archaeological work is planned for the Upward Sun River site, which UAF's Potter describes as unique in the New World for the volume of well-preserved and dated material it contains. The project is funded by the National Science Foundation. A paper on the infant remains is published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a man from Nome finds a World War II memento on the beach.
To me, this is somebody's life, and it obviously was lost, and it had to find its way back to where it belonged.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
It's Veterans Day, and as military forces continue drawing down from deployments abroad, more service members are transitioning back into the civilian workforce. As KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports, a job fair on Friday in Anchorage is one of the ways the state is matching vets with employers in the public and private sectors.
Dressed in her camo fatigues on a break from work at J-Bear, Sergeant Alina Withers still has another year in the Army, but she says she feels behind the curve job hunting.
I feel like I should have started a long time ago. You know, I honestly feel like I shouldn't have ever taken my eyes off of this civilian job market. Finding a job and just learning how to network is, like, that's a skill set in itself.
Alaska has the highest number of vets per capita of any state in the nation, 15%. They face unemployment rates just slightly below their unenlisted counterparts. A state policy gives veterans priority at job centers, offers employers tax credits, and organizes job fairs like the one at University Center in Midtown. Withers was taking a break from examining folding tables covered in handouts and displays from over 100 companies attending the fair. As a combat medic in Afghanistan, she shouldered a lot of responsibility and is discouraged by the likelihood of carrying those skills into her next job.
The problem that I've been seeing is that I don't have the civilian certifications that back up the training that I've and the skill set that I've learned how to do. So I'm having to be forced to go back to school regardless of whether or not I'm really good at that job.
Withers was with her friend, Maria Gusto, who's been looking for a job since the summer after 4 years as an Army HR officer. It hasn't been going very well. She thinks that civilians don't always understand. She not only learned a job, it was a hard job.
We would train as if we were deployed, so we would get attacked, you know, in the middle of the night or in the middle of the day, and you're in the middle of doing your work, and, you know, you have to go into your bunker. So it's definitely more stressful than the civilian life.
Employers often look at a job candidate's time in the service as a black box, not always knowing what happened inside. Many veterans may have never applied for a job and not know how to translate their work histories into civilian terms. Craig Crawford is a vice president at CH2M Hill, one of the companies collecting resumes at a booth near an athletic store. The company does a lot of construction and support services for Alaska's oil and gas industry. Crawford says many veterans learned how to do the same work in the service.
So just about every job you can imagine in the military is reflected again in the oil and gas field, right? We got to have security, we got to have administrative help, we have to have welders, pipe fitters, millwrights, all of those skill sets. We have to have frontline supervision, which looks like a sergeant. We got to have captains, lieutenants, even a few generals.
Crawford believes the current troop drawdown is creating a much needed stateside pool of skilled labor. It's a sensible but slightly optimistic take. Stephen Williams coordinates employment for veterans with the state's Department of Labor and says it's a common experience for transitioning vets to feel overqualified for civilian life.
I think one of the challenges that comes with transitioning out of the military is having to start from scratch. You know, when I was deployed, I was 20 years old, and more than just equipment, I was trusted with lots of equipment there, vehicles, but also just the lives of my supervisor. And then the struggle comes when you transition in the civilian sector and you come with all this experience, all this responsibility, and then you're trusted with a broom.
Sergeant Alina Withers says her priorities in the years ahead are starting a family and going back to school. She's keeping her eyes and ears open, but for a new job, not yet a new career. Still, she says job fairs like this are important for getting a better sense of the part-time work that's out there.
I didn't realize that there was jobs outside of the medical field that are still kind of paramedical. And what they provided was services to people that, you know, in-home services. They'll do your laundry, clean your house, you know, whatever you need done for on an hourly basis.
Withers traded info with a company and was happy to have made the connection, even if it's a year away from potentially panning out. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
British Columbia officials say they understand why Alaskans are concerned about new mines planned for transboundary rivers. But critics on this side of the border say they're not doing anything about it. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Canada's farthest west province is in the midst of a mining boom. With government support, more than half a dozen projects are under exploration or development near rivers where Alaska salmon spawn and live. British Columbia's top mining official says he's not ignoring objections from fishermen, environmentalists, and tribal leaders on this side of the border.
My message to Alaskans is not, you know, don't worry, be happy, nothing to worry about.
Bill Bennett is BC's Minister of Energy and Mines. He recently visited Alaska to meet with government officials and address the State Mining Association.
I think that people who are downstream from any industrial activity have every right to know what's going on, to express their point of view, and we in BC need to be listening.
There's no policy set that allows us to have any influence in what is happening on the Canadian side.
Jill Weitz works for Trout Unlimited. She's part of a recent Salmon Beyond Borders tour throughout Southeast Alaska. Appearances in five cities drummed up opposition to transboundary mines.
Canada has come in and they have essentially weakened some of their environmental regulations as far as streamlining permitting processes.
Tour speakers cited plans for the Kerr Sulphurets Mitchell, or KSM, project, one of the most controversial near-border mines. They said its water treatment plant will not be up to Alaska standards. Bennett says that's not true. He says BC's government has strict rules to protect the environment from mine runoff and other pollution.
It's just not credible to suggest that somehow or other we have, you know, some sort of a weak process in British Columbia and that it's easy to build a mine there and operate a mine there because it isn't.
Bennett says he wants Alaskans to know his agency has been working with the State Department of Natural Resources to address concerns. He says the same is true for KSM developers.
I had assumed that if the Department of Natural Resources was engaged in the assessment of the KSM project, that first of all, that the public would be aware of that, and that secondly, the officials involved would be accountable to some elected folks.
Salmon Beyond Borders and other critics, including several state lawmakers, don't have much faith in that process. Weitz of Trout Unlimited says they're lobbying for a U.S.-Canada panel that considers cross-boundary issues to take it up. She says her coalition wants the panel to look at all the transboundary projects, not just one or two. This is Ed Schoenfeld, reporting from Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. And by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
Local filmmaker Mary Kotsky of Affinity Films has taken on the subject of family members caring for loved ones with Alzheimer's disease. Kotsky says she started out documenting friends in the sandwich generation, those with careers, children at home, and also caring for aging parents. But she focused in on five families dealing with Alzheimer's because of the emotional toll of caring for a family member who may not recognize you. One of those caregivers is Janet Burtz, who has been caring for her mother since her father passed away in 2010. Kotsky says in a state with the fastest growing elder population per capita of any other, exploring the individual decisions that each family has to make is timely.
Everyone in our film starts off with the best of intentions and wants to do what their parents want. And there's also a very serious economic factor in the equation. It's astronomical to take them and place them in third-party care. As our expert says in the film, there are six people doing your job. And when you have to pay those six people in order to do round-the-clock care that you'd be doing at home. Yet 90% do start off at home with a family member. And then there are tipping points along the way, such as a fall that is complicated and necessitates round-the-clock, trained nursing staff. Also, when the parent stops recognizing the child, sometimes their own son or daughter, that can release some of the guilt that can be felt when you turn your parent over to third-party care. Janet might be better to address how that feels and why that decision was made, but at some point, everyone in the film does make that decision.
Well, this is a good opportunity to turn to you now, Janet, to talk about your one of the families featured in the film. Tell us about the situation that you're dealing with and how it progressed.
When my dad passed away, we moved her to where we live in Washington. So we moved from Alaska, where we'd lived for 47 years. So she started by living with us. We had in-home health care come to help her, and they would leave early without notifying us. And one day, the worst thing could have happened is I got a call from the ambulance service saying my mother had fallen and the caregiver was not there. They needed into my home. So upon getting them in, she had surgery. She shattered her shoulder. She never came out of the anesthesia very well. So she went into a nursing home and then into an assisted living. And things just kind of changed. And then one day she showed up at lunch without her pants on. And then it progressed from there to where she couldn't even feed herself. And now it's when I can tell when she's having a bad day, she won't turn her wheelchair around to speak to me. So it's because she can't figure out who I am.
How is that, especially trying to deal with your own family that you have and your children, even if they're grown, they still have needs of their parents? How difficult is it to balance this and also to have the time for yourself that you need to heal?
I think I get through a lot of it by humor, and then I kind of just shut down and I go in a room and hide for a little bit, because it's when my mother keeps asking me the same questions over and over and over again. You know what it's like when a small child does that, and then finally you just agree to whatever. And that's kind of what Alzheimer's is. They are backing out of time. So it's, how do you mother your own mom when she's 83 years old?
I think one of the lessons to come out of this is, and I'm going to ask people to take Thanksgiving this year. This is my call to action. And talk to your parents, talk to your kids, talk to your spouse about what would you like for you if this happens. And have that discussion. It doesn't have to be gloom and doom. It can be Janet style, filled with humor.
Mary, would you say that that's what you want people to take away from this film when they see it?
That's one big important one. And it is this compassion factor, whether it's someone lost in a bank or it's a close friend who's caring for a parent, they may be shielding or hiding what they're really going through from you. But just know that a little bit of respite, a kind act, some help unexpectedly. I'll sit with her while you go to a movie. Something small like that can be huge. And we are modeling for our children. We're modeling for them how we hope to be treated, and that's a good thing for them to see.
Affinity Films' new documentary, Backing Out of Time, will be showing at the Beartooth Theater Pub in Anchorage tomorrow night at 5:30. Southeast Alaska Native veterans honored Tlingit Code Talkers at a Veterans Day ceremony this morning in Juneau. The families of five men who served during World War II received medals and congressional certificates recognizing their service. Tony Jacobs' dad and uncle were among the soldiers who used Tlingit to relay important information during the war.
The Tlingit Indians had their own Tlingit names for various places around Southeast. And that's what they were used for, is to let the ship's captain or quartermasters know where they were located secretly, actually, to where enemy forces would not be able to ID their location.
Jacob says he was overcome with emotion at the recognition. He served in the Navy himself during the 1970s and says he'd recommend military service to anyone.
You get benefits, health benefits, education benefits, and you get to see the country and or the world.
More than 100 people attended the Southeast Alaska Native Veterans Ceremony held at the Tlingit and Haida Central Council's Elizabeth Paratovich Hall. Mark Jacobs Sr., Harvey Jacobs, Jeff David, Richard Bean Sr., and George Lewis were all posthumously honored by Congress last year. After 70 years, dog tags that belong to a World War II soldier who was stationed in Nome are on their way home to his family. KNOM's Jen Ruckel has the story.
Nome resident Mario Gandolfo was combing the Bering Sea coast recently for sea glass when he says the small brass treasure found its way into his hands.
I bent down to pick up a piece of sea glass, and the wave went out. And as I was picking it up, the wave came back in, and with the wave, the only way I can describe it, it was almost as if God's hand had incorporated into a wave, and he placed this 1943 World War II dog tag into my hand. And I just looked at it and stood up like it was in complete shock.
Perfectly preserved, though battered by the waves, the dog tag identified Earl Vogelaar as a soldier from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Gandolfo says immediately he wondered what happened to the soldier and how his tag wound up in the Bering Sea.
I was in basically a mild state of shock because this was all these things were going through my mind. Were they out on maneuvers and they hit a reef or something out off of Nome and they sunk and everybody was lost on board? You know, I mean, all these things were going through my mind. It's like, I've got to find out what happened to this man.
After a bit of investigation with the help from social media and a Grand Rapids television station, Vogelaar's family was located. It turns out the soldier was stationed at what is now the Nome Airport. He was a member of the 11th Air Force Squadron and helped transport tanks and planes from the lower 48 to Alaska. A survivor of the war, Vogelaar finished his life as a welder and died in 1994. Due to a family feud, Vogelaar never knew his grandson, Dustin, but Gandolfo was able to meet Dustin over Skype to share the news of the recovered tag and see photos of Vogelaar as a young soldier.
Even right now, sitting here, my arms, the hair is standing up. I just get all chilled thinking about it. I mean, most people's reaction would be, that's cool, I'm going to keep this. But to me, this is somebody's life, and it obviously was lost, and it had to find its way back to where it belonged.
Vogelaar's tag is currently on its way home to Linda, his eldest daughter. And Gandolfo says he's happy his stroke of luck came at the opportune time.
I feel really good, especially because of the fact that I found these people before Veterans Day. That makes it even the more special, you know. And there's not that many World War II vets left, and we should cherish and honor them as much as we can every day of the week.
And if this rare find isn't impressive enough, Gandolfo added he believes he found two other military relics along the beach this week, a Confederate States of America brass belt buckle and a fork from the U.S. Army. In Nome, I'm Jen Ruckel.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Dan Brass in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld and Casey Kelly in Juneau, and Jen Ruckel in Nome. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez also reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Salmon are all around us. They're in our rivers and our freezers. They fuel our economies and keep Alaskans connected to our traditions, our families, and our friends. The Salmon Project celebrates all the ways salmon are interwoven with our Alaskan lives. Learn more about the project and find out how you can be involved at salmonproject.org or find them on Facebook. Salmon, it runs deep in all Alaskans. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.